15. Much love. We're going to be doing a top 20 of the year of what Rebel Diaz plays. So make sure y'all tune in as the last couple Wednesdays of the month of 2016 go. This has been a rough year, but we are a people of resilience, a people of struggle, and a people, like my brother River said, when you're down and out, there's nowhere to go but up.
That's right.
Been the history of all of our peoples. We are survivors. You know what I'm saying? Whether
the end is near. The beginning is near.
So whether we from Chile, from Brazil, from Chicago, from Puerto Rico, from the Dominican Republic, the Bronx, Brooklyn, the Heights, wherever you at, know that Rebel Diaz Radio got your back and that we as a people are going to survive. Standing Rock, we stand with you. Let's go.
Many shapes, the bear, the elk, the antelope, the elephant, the deer, the mineral, the iron, the copper, the colt, and the rubber, the coffee, the cotton, the sugar, the people. The germ traveled faster than the bullet. They harvest the mountainside, protect the crops, herd the cattle. The people. The women and children were separated from the men. They are divided us according to the regional filters of their minds. The violence of arrogance crawls into the air, nestles into the geospatial cortex. We are not a conquered people.
And it is 12 a.m. midnight here in New York City, 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York. Catherine Davis is on assignment, as we say in the radio world, meaning she's on vacation or traveling, but not here. She had recorded a program, but unfortunately her computer crashed. So we are going to present instead the Aware Show, heard ordinarily on WBAI, noon on Fridays. At 1 a.m. Counterspin, Jim Freund will be along live with Hour of the Wolf at 1:30 and Lister Live burning the flag at 3 o'clock. So stay tuned to WBAI New York.
Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. And welcome.
welcome to the Aware Show. This is Lisa Garr, and it is such a great, great honor and privilege to be speaking with you today, especially about topics that matter so much to our hearts. And these are topics that raise your level of conscious awareness. It's all about awareness. And in order to make any type of change in your life at all, you need to be aware of what it is that you want to change, or aware of what's broken, or aware of what's working. So that's what we're talking about here. And I want to mention to you that one of the greatest ways to stay aware is through meditation and visualization. And I recorded a really, really great visualization that you can find on my website for free. It's, my website is theawareshow.com/gift. And it's my gift to you to take you through a visualization that basically goes on a journey, a very fun journey, into higher levels of thinking, of consciousness, and rising above lower levels of thinking, like negative thinking and self-judgment, and rising above all of that to a great higher level of awareness, and then creating a goal within that higher level of awareness, and finding your guidance in that, all sorts of great things on that journey. So go to my website, which is theawareshow.com/gift. It's one of the most important things to do, is to stay grounded and centered amidst all of the turmoil that's happening in our world, in your life, in my life, wherever. So staying focused and staying grounded is very important, and I do that through visualization, and it's a great way to change. So it's one of the things that we're talking about today. Are you one of those, or do you know someone who might be overwhelmed, overextended, an enabler by doing too much, then turning into a doormat? Or maybe in a way where you're so overwhelmed that you don't understand or what it means to say no or set healthy boundaries. Or what if you're just saying yes to so many things because you do truly love them and you really find passion in what it is that you do, but you don't know how to do it without raising your stress levels. Specifically, we're talking about women. And there's a huge history that comes around vitality for women. From where we were to where we are to where we're going requires telling that story. And that's exactly what Dr. Keisha Ewers does. Is she is a board-certified functional medicine specialist in Ayurvedic medicine as well as functional medicine and integrative medicine. And she is also the founder of something called HealthyYouRadio.com. But she's been in her 40 years or 30 years of medical practice. She has learned that it really, about the female history and the female vitality all around the world is the same. And she is also a functional sexologist. And we're going to talk about what sexology is as well. So welcome, Dr. Keisha. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So let's start about the history here, the history of women's vitality. Where did we come from? Let's take 50 years ago, 50, 60 years ago.
I was just talking to a patient about this just 15 minutes ago.
Cool.
And she was asking why she's going through this perimenopausal period of time where she's waking up in the middle of the night and can't get back to sleep. Her memory is shot. She's having hot flashes, and she's saying, I'm not even into menopause, and my mother didn't have this problem. According to her, her menopause was nice and smooth. And what I explained to her is I said, you know, a couple generations ago, according to the movies that I see, women had time often to hang their laundry out on the line and then chat with each other or play cards with one another in the middle of the afternoon or, you know, take some rest breaks. And I said, as they entered toward that time when the ovarian function is starting to diminish because of menopause and the adrenal function is supposed to take over for your hormone production, we're burning our adrenal glands out in our generation because we're trying to bring home the bacon, fry it up in a pan, and look hot at the same time and be super mom while we're doing all of it. And we're just burning our little adrenal glands out. They're the ones that sit on top of the kidneys, and they are the responders, the first responders to the fight-or-flight message we get from our brains. So we live in this time that we're really, we kind of painted ourselves into a corner, and we're burning ourselves out. So we've come from a time when women are traditionally thought of as the nurturers, the storytellers, the holders of the wisdom of society. And we're kind of making it so we're not that anymore. We're becoming very drained of our vitality. We have hormone imbalances. Libido is gone. And, you know, women are kind of more in a survival mode than a thriving mode. Mm-hmm. And so this is my mission, is to get some life energy and life juice and passion back into women, because we are the glue that holds society together. We're the ones that teach the children. We're the ones that bear the children. We're pretty important in the whole scheme of things.
Yes, but there's no model to show us how to do that. There's no model out there that we can, that we've been raised with. There's Rosie the Riveter, but she had the, you know, that workforce energy. But I don't think it was Rosie the Mother Riveter or Rosie, you know, the Housekeeper Riveter. You know, she was simply just a symbol of women going into the future of the workforce, but not
so much.
We've
got some role models, though, Lisa.
Who? Tell me.
Well, we've got the 13 grandmothers, right?
Yeah.
We've got people that are... I feel like in Peru, I take groups to Peru often, and I just got back from Kenya, Africa, Sunday. I take groups to Africa every year, and I work with people on what I call the medicine wheel, and it's this really amazing retreat that I do with women. And when they're in time out of space like that, and an energy that still has that tribal force to it, and that slower than we have societal rhythm, they just say, wow, how can I bring this back in, you know? And I say, well, you are now the container for that, and you're the role model for it. Mm. So in Peru, they have this prophecy, and part of the prophecy talks about the fact that the puma, which is the symbol of earthly life in Andean cosmology, is awake in South America, but it's asleep in North America. And that there's going to be a time when the puma wakes up in North America and assumes its power. And, you know, we're supposed to be the most, according to a lot of people, the most powerful planet on the Earth. And yet, you know, we have this kind of burned out thing going on. And what they mean by awakened is to really awaken consciously to our consciousness and be the light in the world that we really can be. And I feel like that's happening. You know, I have so many really, really awakened, fantastically conscious women that come on these retreats with me and that I communicate with on my online programs. And I just feel like women are thirsting for this. And they're heeding the call. You know, you're one of them. You're a great role model.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
It doesn't mean you're perfect. And I think that's one of the traps that women fall into. You know, the whole bring home the bacon, fry it up in a pan and look hot at the same time and be super mom while you're doing all of it is the assumption that you have to be perfect. And, you know, that's a cognitive distortion that I had when I was younger and I drove myself into the ground trying to achieve it. It's one of the impossible tasks, is to try to attain a perfection in all that you do.
Right.
You know, the perfection is the imperfection, right? That you're able to learn from your so-called mistakes, and that you're able to say, oh, that didn't work. Now I'm going to adjust, and I'm going to go forward with this new knowledge and information I just got. You know, I'm going to learn how to forgive my hurts. I'm going to, all the things that we gain in wisdom as we age, that's the perfection of it all. So
that
the
is,
trap of trying to be perfect is a good adrenal burner outer.
So the perfection is the non-perfection.
Right.
That's exactly the but how do you explain that to the husband that wants the affection when you have nothing left to give, or the children that need your attention when you have none of it to give to yourself? How do you explain that, hey, everybody, it's not going to be perfect?
You know, that's such a great question, and I get asked this quite often. Doesn't what you do, Dr. Keisha, wear you out? How do you get all this stuff done, you know? Mm-hmm. I always say that I'm not the doer. If you really live in a spiritual space, you know, and you've had a near-death experience, and so have I, and so when you get to the other side and you start reviewing your life, you go, oh, that's how this works, right?
Yeah.
actually all about energy and love. And so when you come back, you can kind of say, I'm a conduit for that energy. I'm not the doer. I'm not the one that does this, right? The energy of the universe works through me. And when you can really understand that, when I teach intuitive development classes and I used to teach energy workshops and things like that, I would tell my students, if you're exhausted at the end of the day, that means that you are working with your ego, not with spirit working through you. Working with spirit through you as a mother, as a wife, as a healer, whatever it is you're accomplishing in your world, whatever your life path and purpose is, if you're working with spirit working through you rather than you being thinking you're the one doing it, you will not get exhausted from it.
What about when you're building something or starting something where you held this vision and you're working it out as you go along? When you do have to
become attached to an outcome about how it's supposed to be, then you're going to get tired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you say, okay, I have this vision and I'm working as a co-creator with the universe in accomplishing this vision for the greater good of humanity, and then I turn it over. I do this work, right? I do what I'm inspired to do, and then I turn over the eventual outcome so I can kind of get out of the way. And if it's supposed to be something a little different than what I have pictured, and, you know, the universe has a different plan for it, then I'm not going to be disappointed if it doesn't match the picture in my head.
Mm.
You know, we get so trapped by, we have a picture in our heads when our babies are born about what this baby's going to turn out like, or when we marry a spouse and what our marriage is going to be like. And then, or, you know, as children, if you read stories or you see other kids' mothers or fairy tales that you watch on television and your family doesn't look like that, that to me is the biggest teaching I've ever received in life, is that all unhappiness comes from unmet expectations. So, you know, and so I think when you're building something, if you're doing it in the flow of the universe, you know, you can get tired by the end of the day and fall into bed with this happy exhaustion. But as far as saying I've been drained, you know, then it's not in the flow.
Interesting. Well, do you think this contributes to the enormous rise in the autoimmune diseases in our country, at least?
Because that whole thing that I was just talking about, that all unhappiness comes from unmet expectations, there's a study that was done between 1995 and 1997 called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, or ACE study. And Ayurvedic medicine is a sister science of yoga. It's 10,000 years old, and these guys knew this, what I'm about to talk about in Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine and a lot of the natural medical healing modalities, that your mind and your body and your spirit and your heart are one system. But in conventional medicine and science, we've divided them all out. So the ACE study was really pivotal and very important because it brought the conversation of mind, body, spirit, and heart into our scientific community conversation. And what the ACE study did is it was done by the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, and Kaiser Permanente. And there were 17,000 participants in the study. And what they were looking at is, does childhood affect adult health? Do adverse childhood experiences or different kinds of traumas affect the health of the adult who experienced those traumas? And what they found is that, indeed, it does. And in fact, over two-thirds of those 17,000 people that were studied had an ACE score of at least one. And what that meant was the ACE experiences, the adverse childhood experiences that they were studying, you know, it's by no means exhaustive. They picked 10 things. Five of them were about abuse, so sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical, psychological, right? So five different kinds of abuse. And then five of them were about neglect, the loss of a parent through either divorce or, in my case, my dad was in the Navy and took off for 2 years at a time out to sea. Or a parent that they watched get beaten, or a parent that had a drug or alcohol addiction and just simply wasn't present, right? And so these are called adverse childhood experiences in this study. And This is so fascinating because each one of those is counted as one point. Then you can go online and you can look at the ACE study, and it has a little quiz, and you can see if you have an ACE score. I have an ACE score of 2. Well, I got rheumatoid arthritis when I was 30. Mm-hmm. I was sexually abused when I was 10. And my dad was in the Navy, and like I said, wasn't around a bit of my childhood. And so when I talk to my patients about this, or I teach about it and write about it, what I say is, this is just information. To me, knowledge is power, right? So this is just information. It doesn't say, wow, I'm really, really screwed up. There's just no way out, right? It just says, oh, interesting. This is connected to this. This thing that I'm suffering with in my life can be connected to this adverse childhood experience I had. The great news is that we now know that our brains have this great thing called neuroplasticity, and we can create new synapses in there, and we can work with fantastic tools and that are necessary and responsible for our evolutionary development, like forgiveness. And we can develop compassion and compassionate awareness. This is what you teach. All this is really, really powerfully important for how our genes, our genetics, show up. Mm-hmm. So I have a family history of rheumatoid arthritis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis when I was 30. Mm-hmm. My rheumatologist said, well, looks like it's genetic. Take these drugs. And gave me methotrexate, which is a cancer-fighting drug, and nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs for the inflammation. Well, when I went home and I looked at the side effects, I was in the Western medical community at the time, and I thought, oh, you know, that was the only thing I knew. I didn't even know what an herb was. I didn't know anything about what I do today. Mm. And I just thought, these side effects are terrible. Why would I do this? I'm going to die from the side effects, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I had 4 little children that I was
raising.
And I 4. Just thought, wow. I don't want this. My grandfather had been in a wheelchair. I knew what this looked like at its end stage. And so I started really looking online at what were some other things you could do for autoimmune disease. And I found that there were studies on yoga and meditation for autoimmunity. So, you know, that led me to Ayurvedic medicine, led me to learn how to meditate, to become really aware of my body and my relationship to my body. So it's a really important thing that's happening right now for us to look at, this rise in autoimmune disease in our society. It's one of the fastest growing disease segments that we have, and within that term, autoimmune, there are over 189 different diseases.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot.
It's our immune system attacking us. And
yes.
When I really sat with myself in meditation one day and I looked at the word autoimmune, I realized I was committing suicide.
Wow.
In a societally acceptable way. A way that, you know, no one would ever say was suicide. But I realized if I'm killing myself, if my immune system has turned on me, then I must have something going on here in my cells. I must have made an agreement that I want out. And that's when I went back to that 10-year-old little girl that was being sexually abused in elementary school. And I thought, oh, she didn't feel safe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't feel protected because I told teachers and they didn't believe me. And so I had made an agreement with myself that when life gets too hard, I get to check out. It's this world's not a fun place to be in, and I didn't like it. Mm. And my cells kept that message until I went back and changed it.
Ah, you identified it. How did you identify that was the source?
I was really looking at that word autoimmune and realizing that I was killing myself. And so then I started looking for that. Like, when's the first time I didn't want to be alive?
Mm.
You know?
Yes.
How old did I feel at that moment? And that's when I went back and I went, oh, of course.
And that's what you help people with today is tracking back, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you do that, when you really help them track back, do you find that their illness starts to subside?
Yes, if they're willing. A lot of people will say, you know, whether they say it out loud or not, so you're blaming me? You're saying this is my fault?
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know? And it's not about blame. That paradigm of blaming and shaming and having a fault-finding mission is a lower state of consciousness, you know. It's not a very developed way of thinking about things. And so I'll say, of course not, you know, but your immune system is going after you. So can we create a collaborative relationship between your immune system and you and your mind and your heart and your spirit and your body? Can you be with me in that way that we're going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Some people never come back. Some come back 4 years later and say, this has actually happened several times. Okay, what you told me is absolutely true. I completely resonate with you, and now I have another autoimmune disease. I'm ready.
Mm-hmm.
It really is a matter of readiness and willingness.
Well, it manifests in several ways. One is autoimmunity, and you've done a great job in explaining the psychological link there. And then there's also the libido question.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's low libido, is that usually the benchmark of abuse on that scale that you mentioned, the adverse childhood experiences? Or do you think it has to do with just simply what a doctor would say, your hormones are out of balance?
So I started really investigating the question of libido when I found that I didn't have any when I was at when I had rheumatoid arthritis. I thought, mm-hmm. wow, my fire is completely out, you mm-hmm. know. And as a clinician, when I developed a program to help women with libido, it's called the Libido Cure Program, I reached out to a colleague who works a lot with women with Hashimoto's, which is an autoimmune thyroid issue. And she said, you know what, Keisha, my patients do not care about their sex drive. All they care about is being able to get 1 foot in each leg of their pants every morning and to get to the bathroom to brush their teeth. And I thought about that. I said, you're absolutely right. When I had RA, I remember that feeling of, let's just take one segment of task at a time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about that, and I thought, gosh, these are linked so definitively, because in Ayurvedic medicine, libido could be thought of as a Sanskrit word that they call ojas. And ojas is your life essence. It's your life force. And it's a product of the healthy metabolism of your nutrition. So Ayurveda looks at us and says we have 7 different tissue layers in our bodies. You know, it's the skin, and then it keeps going all the way down to your reproductive tissues. And whatever you eat and whatever you think and whatever you believe are metabolized, okay? So you turn your food into cells and energy for your body. You tune your sensory perceptions into thoughts and beliefs. And if those are not healthy, any of them, if they're not metabolized well, then you're going to get sick. So, mm-hmm. ojas, if you don't have that healthy metabolism through all 7 layers of your tissues, then you don't have enough ojas. And the way they think about it is that you're born with a certain amount of life essence or force, and then you can burn through it and you'll die. So the way that you burn through it is by being angry and by being burned out, not getting enough sleep, eating mm-hmm. the wrong things, masturbating too much. For boys, like ejaculation, you lose ojas. A lot of these kinds of normative things that we do in our society are actually burning out ojas. So ojas is vitality. And the way that I think about it is libido. So libido, you could think of it like an indicator light on your dashboard. It's like your gas gauge. And we know if you're running empty on your gas, that if you push down on the gas pedal as hard as you can and you expect your car to go faster and further on an empty tank, you're going to be very disappointed. You'll break down on the side of the road. But when our indicator light, our gas gauge for our fuel in our bodies is really low, we push down on the gas tank, on the gas pedal, and we think we're going to go further and faster. And we do things like reach for coffee and sugar and Red Bull and all these different things to keep going in spite of the fact that the indicator light is blinking red, saying you don't have enough fuel, right? So then we wind up with no libido. We wind up getting overweight. We wind up having mood disorders because we're cranky and anxious and depressed and we can't sleep and all of these different things that I see in women every day. This is the root cause of a lot of hormone imbalances. So oftentimes women will say, they'll come in to see me and they'll say, Dr. Keisha, my libido's gone to Tahiti and left me behind and I need some hormones, right?
Right, right. That's the quick fix, right?
Right. You gave hormones to my colleague at work and she said she feels fantastic and I want some of that.
She's swinging from the chandeliers, yes.
Right, right. And so I'll say, okay, so bioidentical hormones are helpful in a lot of different cases, so let me talk to you a little bit first. And so I start asking her about her story. And so I'll say, how long ago has it been since you had a libido that you were happy with? And sometimes a woman will look at me and say, well, I've never had one. Hmm. And I'll say, well, estrogen and progesterone and testosterone are not going to help that, you know? Mm-hmm. They're not going to raise something from the dead. And so, or they'll say, you know, I haven't had libido for this period of time. And I'll say, so do you like your partner, your sex partner, your husband? And then sometimes I get tears, like they'll cry and say, oh, you had an affair 5 years ago, and you know. So what I discovered, I went back to school and I got my doctorate in sexology because I really wanted to understand where is women's vitality going? What can we do to bring this back? Because hormones are the answer in a small segment of this, but not the bigger picture. And what I discovered in my research is that there are 5 root causes to low libido.
Hmm.
Yeah, 5.
Wow.
It's a really complex dynamic situation.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why when we're looking for a pill to solve it, I kind of roll my eyes because we're not all the same person and there are not all the same reasons for libido to be low. So the 5 root causes are, one of them is physical, another is emotional, another is mental, another is spiritual, and then the other one is in the libido story. And often there are intersections between all of these where it's not just one thing, right? So for example, the woman whose husband had an affair, there's an emotional root cause to that because she's got some held on to hurt and betrayal of trust inside of her relationship. Well, then that translates over a period of time to an adrenal burnout because she's in fight or flight all the time. Should I stay? Should I go? How come he did this? What's wrong with me that I would, you know, all the questions. And so then that does create a hormone imbalance because as the adrenals get burned out, they steal from your ovarian production of progesterone because survival will always trump over sex.
Mm-hmm.
The body wants to survive more than it wants to reproduce. So I always say if you're a lion being chased by, or if you're a zebra being chased by a lion, that zebra actually knows if it thinks it's about to be lunged that it's not safe to stop and have sex.
Right, right. So that energy goes towards flight.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and that ties in with the physical and the emotional and the mental can all kind of start to tie together, and the spiritual and the, and that creates
the spiritual
story. Well, that's kind of different. Yeah.
Sometimes women are raised inside of conservative church cultures or family cultures that are not sex positive.
Yeah.
And what that means is that sex and sexual desire are put forth as sin and bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea that good girls don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're allowed to get married and turn on the faucet, and it doesn't turn on. Nothing comes out because you've been so used to suppressing it and thinking that if you're a good girl, you don't feel this. So it becomes very difficult for some women to be able to have orgasms, to have sexual desire, to feel like it's okay for them to be sensual beings, which, we have a clitoris. We're the only ones in the two genders that have a little gland in our bodies that is only meant for pleasure.
That's the one source of, that is the one thing that it's meant for?
That's the one thing. That's the only thing it's for, is for your pleasure.
It doesn't have any other function. That's it. That's its only job.
That's it. Mm. And who gave it to you? If you believe you're a sentient being created by God, why would God give you something for pleasure and then deny you?
And say, you can't use this. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
And then does that get into the libido story?
Right. So along, you know, with I coined this term libido story because as I would talk to women and I would say, so tell me when you very first, you know, started feeling like you have a lack of sexual desire. And then sometimes they'll be cognizant enough to say, well, you know, I was sexually abused. I've been through therapy. I have, you know, and they'll kind of go, I'm mm-hmm. sure this is tied together, right? And so I'll go backwards with them. This is called your love map. And in research, we say that during your different stages of human growth and development, you can have an alteration in your love map along the way that will influence how you are as a sexual being later on in life. And so sexual abuse is definitely one of them. Another one, though, that, you know, and actually it's not just one, but it's all about those beliefs that you come out of childhood with. Your brain's not developed until you're 26 years old. So if a child experiences something that they can't really understand, like they're rejected on the playground, or they get an F on a report card and they, you know, they take it home and are shamed, then they're going to make up a story about that. Their parents get divorced, or mom is crying one day in the bedroom. You know, children are self-centered. They're supposed to be. That's their job. They're yes. growing. They're trying mm-hmm. to learn about the world and bring in all that they can. And they'll make up stories and make up meanings and create beliefs about experiences that no one that's got a great adult caregiving mind is there to help them understand. And there's no child that comes out of childhood without some belief that is self-limiting in some way. Mm. Just the way it goes. Doesn't mm-hmm. matter how perfect you are as a parent. So when you have that going on, maybe you come out saying, like I did, my vice principal is the one abusing me, and so I would always try to be the most perfect student possible. I didn't want to get called in the principal's office. I was making up a story that I was bad. That's why I kept getting called in there, you know? And so I came out of a childhood with this deep need that actually it wasn't even safe if I wasn't perfect, you know?
Right, right.
Well, you can see how far that would get you.
Not
very. It's pretty exhausting.
Right, right. To constantly have to be perfect so that you,
Mm-hmm. Or if someone's upset with you because you failed them or you failed at something, and then you go into the fight or flight mode, right? Instead of taking it on the chin and saying, oh, yeah, well, I'll do better next time. It's like, no, this is dangerous. I'm not going to survive. And it sets off those same hormones and alarm systems that this is a harmful thing happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so the treatment for this is therapy. Lots of it.
Talk therapy?
Pardon?
Talk therapy?
You know, you already know what I'm going to say about that. So, It can actually, research shows that it can take 20 years to make improvement with talk therapy. It's really
just recycling the same problem over and over.
Yeah. I mean, sure, it helps to get things off your chest, but you can tell your story and solidify it even deeper, right?
Right.
About your victim place in the world. And you can do that with a girlfriend. You don't need to go see a therapist for that. So the best, you know, the best kinds of therapies, if you have an ACE score of one or more that involve trauma release, is really like eye movement desensitization reprogramming. It's called EMDR, or brain spotting is another one that I do. I really like, or clinical hypnotherapy.
Now, what do these things, these types of therapies, do that a good therapist wouldn't do?
So, a good therapist will understand, like NLP is another great thing. So good therapists usually have a bunch of these tools in their toolbox to help people to release trauma. And what they're doing is they're taking those memories from deep within the hippocampus that are only coming out into the limbic system, right, the fight or flight. And they're pulling them out into the conscious mind and saying, oh, look, I made up this meaning, and here's where that feeling is from that meaning in my body, and here's what I believe when it comes up. I'm not safe. Right?
Uh-huh.
So as an adult, there's no way I'm ever going to have that same thing happen to me again. So if I have that feeling come up in my body and I have this feeling of not being safe because I've made a mistake, then clearly it's a distortion. It's not true. Mm. But now I'm 10 years old instead of an adult age. Mm-hmm. And a 10-year-old child doesn't deal well with the complexities of the adult world.
Not at all.
So that's why this kind of therapy is so important.
It doesn't layer over what it is that is already existing, or does it layer over it in a good way?
I didn't understand that question.
Okay, so if you have these issues that happen in childhood and you don't know how to resolve them, and you do something like hypnotherapy, which I believe in and have done, and it really does help, explain why that's so effective. And if people think, oh, no, this is just layering over the problem so that you forget about it, I don't think that necessarily is true. I think it's replacing the bad memory with a positive experience or a resolved experience so that you don't completely continue to relive that experience as you do in talk therapy, right?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I want to clarify something because hypnosis or hypnotherapy, like for weight loss or stopping smoking or something like that, is where you're just replacing one thought for another, actually is not what I'm talking about.
Cool.
So clinical hypnotherapy does much the same thing as EMDR and brain spotting, where you're actually getting into where does it live in your body, what's the belief you have about it, how old do you feel right now, and then you go back and you reparent that wounded part of you and reclaim your power that you gave up in that moment. So it's really not just about replacing one thought for another. You really do need to reparent the kid that didn't get what they needed in that moment.
That's beautiful. Okay, got it. That's important. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, are there people that come to you and say, listen, my libido's low and it happened after childbirth and my hormones dropped after that and that's all that it is?
Yep.
Or
I had this rockin' sex drive, Dr. Keisha, and then I went through menopause. And, you know, it feels like I have cut glass in my vagina when I have intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I prescribe bioidentical hormones is, you know, for those instances. And if there's a history of trauma and someone has adrenal fatigue and their hormones are completely emptied out, I give them bioidentical hormones too. But I also say, look, we have to also patch the hole in the bottom of your boat here.
Otherwise, this
is going to get you nowhere and actually put you at risk for breast cancer if we don't do this right. Mm. So it's important that you understand the root, right? And so remember I told you there are these five root causes. Well, under physical, your libido can disappear if you go on a serotonin reuptake inhibitor antidepressant. Your libido can disappear if you get diabetes or heart disease and you go on some of the medications that are given for those. Your libido will disappear if you have surgery and you're recovering or you've had chemotherapy or radiation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in these cases, it's important to fix that physical root issue, and sometimes you need some bioidentical hormone replacement.
Okay, so it's part of it. So
yes.
Let me see if I got the formula right here. Trauma equals fatigue, early adrenal fatigue, which equals a drop in hormones, which can equal autoimmune dysfunction, cancer disease, etc. Did I get that right?
The connection missing? Between autoimmune disease and the drop in hormones is not quite accurate.
Okay.
When you have autoimmune disease, everybody with autoimmune disease has what's called intestinal permeability syndrome or leaky gut.
Mm.
And the connection between your hormones and leaky gut is this. When you're in fight or flight chronically and cortisol is leaking out into your system all the time, cortisol actually is degenerative. It's a stress hormone, and it will break down the lining of your gut wall.
I see.
Yeah.
Mm, it works like an acid.
Yes, it'll break it down, and then you wind up having food sensitivities and things because whatever you're eating, those food particles go out into your body when they're not supposed to be there. It's supposed to be an impermeable gut membrane, and now it's become permeable. And then the immune system tags that and says, hey, you don't belong out here. and makes an antibody against something as stupid as broccoli.
Right, right. So then can I do trauma equals, I'm writing all this out.
I see that. That's good.
I'm really compartmentalizing this for myself. But I can see that. I mean, I could see where if somebody says I have a food sensitivity or I have acid reflux, that the smart people in the Western medicine world would say, okay, well, here is an acid blocker.
Right.
Or if I have a dip in hormones, the smart people in the medical world would say, here are some bioidentical hormones. There's fixes for this out there.
Or synthetic.
Or synthetic. Yeah. Or there's depression. Oh, here is a SSRI. The medical world's figured those out to quick fix those things. Not necessarily quick either, but to put Band-Aids on those things. But the root cause is what I'm talking about with you. Trauma equals adrenal fatigue equals dip in hormones or intestinal permeability, which then results in autoimmunity.
Right.
Did I get that right?
And even cancer.
Right, I got that disease, all
right.
Of that. Is that
any disease,
accurate?
Actually, you can plug it in right there. And so I developed something called the Freedom Framework to treat all of this. It's what I used on myself. And, you know, the different steps of the Freedom Framework, the first one is to really uncover root causes. So you're looking in those five different regions, and it's not just for low libido, but for anything. You want to uncover the root cause. Then you want to connect those dots between any lab work. So you've got to do some lab work and kind of find out what's going on, what's the data your body's trying to convey to you. Always when we have pain in a joint, or we have a headache, or we have cramps, or we're tired, or we start gaining weight, all right, that's just your body trying to give you some information back. And people get really upset by it and say, oh, I got to take some Advil, I have a headache. Instead of asking the body, oh, what are you trying to tell me? What's going on? Oh, it's been 8 hours since I had anything to drink, you know, or I just realized it's been 3 days since I pooped. Mm-hmm. You know, the headache is there for a reason. And so when you try and, like you just said, with Western medicine, put a Band-Aid over the top of it, then it continues. The root cause still is there.
Mm-hmm.
So you really want to confront the data that you get and be willing to say, okay, every single thing I put on my fork is either going to cause inflammation or it's not, and there's no in between. Every single thing I drink is either inflammatory producing or it's not. And I need to get real about what my lifestyle things are. If I don't exercise, then I need to be clear about what it's causing my body. If I don't sleep, go to bed at 10 and get up at 6, then I need to confront this data. You know, this is what's happening. If I look at my scale and I'm not happy with what the needle says, I need to be very, very clear about this. And so then the fourth step in the Freedom Framework is to create the life with intention that you want instead of from what I call factory default settings from childhood. So if you still have those beliefs that are running you, right, then you're creating a life that's from default settings. And nobody takes a new phone out of a box or any new electronic and just uses the factory default settings. We all want to, like, personalize it and make it the coolest thing for us, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's what you want to do with your life, too. You don't want to just have it be run by these old beliefs that you created from a brain that wasn't yet developed fully, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so intending the body you want, intending the lifestyle, the libido you want, intending all that. So did I get this right, the Freedom Framework? One, uncover root causes. Two, lab work. Three, fork.
No. So it's number one is uncover. So it's four C's. Uncover is the first one.
Okay.
The next one is to confront.
Okay.
Right, the data, get the data, then make the connections, so connect, and then create.
Okay. All right. I wrote down fork just because it's, you know, a lot of it's an anti-inflammatory diet, which makes a lot of sense. Which also, you know, no alcohol is important here because exercise, don't anesthetize. That's important.
Right.
So that people aren't adding on the things that continue the, the amnesia.
And also coffee. You don't want to have stimulants in your body where you're having to take an upper in the morning and a downer at night, right?
The coffee. Oh, I see, with the alcohol. Yep, absolutely.
Yep.
And then intention, which is the creating part of it. Right. Now, you mentioned something called the Libido Cure. Is that a part of it?
Yeah, so the Libido Cure program takes people through. You can see how complex this is, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really quite a journey of inner self-discovery to learn about your vitality and where it's gone and to reclaim your passion and your life juice. And oftentimes, you know, women that have been traumatized at some point in their lives, and it's one in four women who have actually had sexual abuse, and half of all women have had some kind of trauma of some sort. So, I'm going to get on a tangent here, and then I need to share one more thing with you.
Okay, good, fine.
You can call those kinds of trauma from the ACE study, capital T trauma, and then you can call, and this was another really fascinating study that I discovered in my research, is lowercase T trauma, which is chronic daily stress. So PET scans, brain imaging that's done of brains, it turns out that actually trauma does damage your brain.
Mm.
Good news is you can reverse it, but so does lowercase t trauma, daily stress, daily stressful life events actually cause the same thing as PTSD does in the brain. So that's a really important thing for people to remember.
Yes.
And it's not really so much about the stress. Like, you know, like I'm a really busy woman. You are too. We're raising children, you know, and you could think you're really stressed out. Well, then you are. But if you think, oh, I'm doing my life purpose and I'm in the flow and I'm just working to co-create wonderful things to help people with the universe, then you don't perceive it as stress. Then the messenger chemicals in your brain don't tell your adrenals to release cortisol. Really, all about
it's
how
interesting.
You think about it, right?
I don't catch myself that way. I mean, yesterday was one really ridiculously, stupidly stressful day, and it wasn't anything catastrophic. It was just the internet went down, and then I couldn't get the guest on the show because it was down, and then it was just like one thing up to the next, and then we had a project that didn't go well and kind of failed, and it was just like blow after blow after blow after blow, minor things. These were not big deals. This is honestly, it's not a big problem. But it was, I didn't have enough time between the events to recover from the last one. So I kept just getting, manage the stress. But I never breathed during the whole, at the end of the day, I felt just totally wiped out because the problems kept going. You know, then I had to reboot, and then I had to, then everything came up wrong, and then it just kept going. And I finally just said, okay, I'm done. I'm walking away. 10 o'clock, I'm going to bed. And I'm going to wake up tomorrow, and everything is going to be a brand new day, and I'm going to look at these challenges that happened the day before and breathe. And so I did that, and I woke up this morning, I got in front of the email, and the email had totally changed, and then I created nice, peaceful support tickets rather than screaming support tickets.
Good. Well, the Libido Cure program helps women to be able to have tools to be able to do that, to manage their lives in such a way that it doesn't send your libido out the window. Because it's 7 weeks of modules that go through all five of the root causes in the entire Freedom Framework and teaches you how to understand your own body, your own mind, your own heart, your own spirit, how it all works together to form vitality or libido. And when I talk about libido, I'm not talking about so much about sex drive.
Okay, because that was the last thing I was thinking of yesterday, honestly.
I'm
so glad you mentioned that.
I don't actually care if you're out there having sex, right? If that makes you happy, then I want you to have the energy
to do it. So it's total vitality. You know, it does.
But it's energy to create, which is what sex is. And so if your energy, this extra energy that you have, right, called Shakti in Eastern philosophy, you can channel that toward anything that you want to have your life stand for in this world.
Because we do manage a lot. I mean, in terms of managing, women tend to manage a household. They tend to manage a family. They tend to manage, even if your significant other is completely helpful, it is a woman's tendency, nature, to want to make the nest, to take care of the nest, to take care of the children in the nest, to take care of the, you know, and then you add on jobs on top of that or businesses or whatever. And then you add on body and, you know, your personal self-care, and it does land. It's not in a victim way that it lands on our shoulders. It's what we're bred to. It's not even breeding. It's what we're, our hormones are designed to do. They just, we are just that way as creatures, as female creatures. We are nurturers.
Right.
And so that nurturing, do you ever address that in these programs?
What, oh, absolutely.
How that nurturing gets out of control or loses its boundaries?
Because I teach people about the Enneagram and the Libido Cure Program and by Ayurveda. And what you start to learn is whatever strategy that you created as a child to get your needs met can be imbalanced. And if it's coming from a place of ego, like mine, I'm a 2 on the Enneagram, which is a way of understanding your strategies. I was reinforced positively for caregiving. Well, what do I do for a living? I've been a caregiver my entire adult world, and I have 4 children. So for me, compassion can turn into be a mercenary currency. I give to you so I get something back, right? Yeah.
Compassion is a mercenary currency.
That's right.
That is a good one.
It's not real. Right. It's a currency, right?
Wow.
And so a lot of women that are rescuers and caregivers and enablers, they have that. And that's not really compassion.
Mm-hmm.
It's currency. And it's actually a manipulation.
Another word for enabling. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I teach women to really understand, like, what are your motivations for getting your needs met in this world? And are they running you, and or are they supporting you? You know? And how to then make that shift. So.
Right. Wow. Where is the next workshop? Can I go there?
The Libido Cure is an online program. We have one live call, and I have a private Facebook that's associated with it, with this incredible tribe of women that are super supportive of each other. And you can find it on the drkeisha.com website under programs. And we're relaunching it again in December of 2016, but it's launched throughout the year. And it's also, you can just register for it and join at any point along the way also.
Very cool. So that's where people can get. And this is a community where you do the program together with people, or how does that work?
Well, it's individual, but then I always say, and then share on your Facebook private page, you know, with the group, what your results are from this, like what's happening for you. And then they share, and they share recipes with each other, and they share their ups, and they share their downs, and their roses and their thorns, and, you know, and they actually help each other. And then I'm in there every day too, and answering questions and supporting. And so it's a really fantastic program.
Fantastic. Wow. That is great. It's very well-rounded. Now, that's different than the Libido Cure program.
That is the Libido Cure program.
That is. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
And then I have another program that's the Academy for Integrative Medicine Health Coach Certification Program, where people can learn to do what I do. And it's a 6-month program. And that program, it's under certification on drkeisha.com.
Now, and also you have this from Fatigue to Fabulous program, which is great. 21 Ways. It was an ebook.
Yes, that's an
ebook.
And that's free for anyone that comes on my site and registers for the free gift.
That's great. That's 21 ways to hack your hormones for a happy life. And this is plus food swaps and recipes.
Right.
That's really great. And that's free for everyone as well. So I'm signing up for it right now. Although I'm on your email already, but I love it. I love that you're so spot on and so right on about all this. And then how do people find out about your tours, your traveling?
That's under retreats on the Dr. Keisha site. And I'm taking a group in 2017, I'm calling it the Avalon Medicine Wheel, where we're going to the Celtic ancient sites of England. And we work with plant medicine and with this deep healing on the medicine wheel with trauma and stuff like that. And then I'm taking a group to Peru in August, and I'm taking a group back to Africa in October. So there are three different options for doing this.
Wonderful. And how many women do you usually have on these retreats?
We get men too. And I cap it at 16. So it's because I work individually with a lot of them during when we're not on the wheel, and I do a lot of therapy on these for people. So.
That's wonderful. And you address all sorts of things, food, you address emotions, everything, right?
Mm-hmm. It's really transformative.
Oh, I'm sure. That's fantastic. And did you do the retreats just as an extension of being able to connect with people individually? You still also have a private practice, right?
I do. I'm in the clinic Monday through Wednesday, and then I write. I'm finishing up a second book right now, and I did these retreats because I can work with people for 14 days at a time, you know, 10 hours a day, and it's a lot more helpful than doing like an hour of therapy every week or working with your diet or, you know.
That's great.
So it allows really deep healing because it's in 14 days.
And where is your clinic, by the way?
It's outside of Seattle, Washington, a suburb called Issaquah.
Wonderful. Well, you have definitely the answer to so many things, and I haven't even had a chance to speak with you about your near-death experience and everything that you gained. Well, I can tell what you gained from that, and that's very transformational. And one of the things that I've learned from interviewing so many people with NDEs, I created a whole series around it because I noticed the conversations that I was having with people who have had near-death experiences, those interviews were so much deeper and so much more intense, and we really start from a different level and go from there. And now I understand why I can connect with you so well, and why we can uncover and reveal so much during an interview is because you've had this experience of exploring the beyond and knowing what's possible. And that's incredible. Where did you have that experience, the NDE?
I was living, I've actually had a couple of them. So one was in Utah with the birth of my fourth child.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. Amazing. My goodness, what a journey you've been on. Well, thank you so much for all you contribute to women. This is such a time where we are in such need of somebody explaining what is going on. And you do it in a beautiful way, in a very compassionate way, and also a way where you give us boundaries. It's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for what you're doing, Lisa.
I try.
You do a great job.
Thanks, Dr. Keisha. It's great to speak with you again. And again, you can go to her website, which is drkeesha.com, and you can find all this great information on there. Thank you so much for joining me, and thank you to my producers, Gina Salvati, goddess, and Joyce Walker, goddess, and also to you, the listener. Thank you so much for joining me in this conversation. Whenever you hear the show, your energy chimes in and makes the show what it is. So thank you very much. And until next time, I invite you to stay aware.
Hi, this is Jake Sufnarowski, former talent buyer at Wetlands Preserve. When I'm not driving my gas guzzling SUV, texting my friends in my handheld mobile device, or listening to my local Clear Channel affiliate, I'm definitely tuned to WBAI, listener-supported non-commercial radio in New York City, 99.5 FM.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised. Rather than take from the election that Democrats have to better intersect defense of the human rights of people of color, women, LGBTQ people, Muslims, and other marginalized groups with a clear progressive economic vision, some in the so-called liberal media now tell us that the lesson actually is we all should, for goodness sake, stop talking about Muslims and queer people and women and the black and brown. That's not, naturally, how social justice advocates are responding. They're getting together to share strategies for protecting vulnerable communities and resisting the predations on our civil rights. One such gathering of activists and academics was a recent webinar hosted by the African American Policy Forum. It featured a range of voices, but I'll bring you just two: Sumi Cho, professor at DePaul University School of Law, and Alicia Garza, co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Also on the show, minimizing and misunderstanding the role of racism in U.S. political life is hardly new. Thanksgiving, for instance, will no doubt include a hefty portion of public delusion about a friendly sharing between settlers and Native Americans. If journalism is the first draft of history, it's also true that misshapen history continues to distort journalism. We'll revisit a conversation we had on that issue with James Lowen, author of the classic Lies My Teacher Told Me. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. Pundits have been scrambling to explain Hillary Clinton's unexpected loss. Reasons offered include WikiLeaks, fake news, and the FBI. Lately, though, as Adam Johnson writes for Fair.org, a new culprit has emerged from center and center-left circles: identity politics and its close cousin, political correctness. So you have Bill Maher saying Democrats, quote, made the white working man feel like your problems aren't real because you're mansplaining and check your privilege, close quote. Democrats' reaction to terrorist attacks, Maher says, is don't be mean to Muslims. And that's not a good way to get votes. Vox editor Ezra Klein teed up an interview with psychologist John Haidt by tweeting, interesting, John Haidt on why diversity, immigration, and multiculturalism are ripping apart Western democracies. Haidt's line is that while multiculturalism and diversity have many benefits, they also amplify tribal tendencies. The politics is always about factions. A world in which those factions are based on race or ethnicity rather than economic interests, he says, that's the worst possible world. Well, Vox doesn't question this false dichotomy, the idea that economic populism and identity politics are mutually exclusive. But advancing populism, while understanding that particular groups have specific concerns, like freedom from discrimination, has always been a mainstay of left politics. But here we've got the New York Times' David Brooks equating, in the time-honored way, anti-racism with racism. Quote, but it's not only racists who reduce people to a single identity. These days it's the anti-racists, too. To raise money and mobilize people, advocates play up ethnic categories to an extreme degree. Close quote. Yes, to fight back against social, economic, and physical oppression, people targeted by racists occasionally raise money and mobilize people who, like them, are targeted by racists, by really playing up that whole targeted by racists thing. It's hard to say how pernicious it is to argue that the people made most vulnerable by a Trump victory are to blame for it. Certainly in the face of an upsurge of reactionary politics, it's also helping provide ideological cover for racists and demagogues. And more in that vein, the celebration of Vice President-elect Mike Pence being confronted by the cast of Hamilton and tweets from Donald Trump showing it got under his skin also brought on a backlash. Don't let Donald Trump's antics distract you from what's really important, was the headline of Matthew Iglesias' scolding in Vox. The truth is that nothing about the Hamilton story is in any way important to how Trump runs the country. What we should be paying attention to, he said, were reports that foreign diplomats are booking rooms at Trump's hotel in Washington, D.C., and that Trump paid $21 million to former students of his fake university. In Politico, Jack Schaefer warned us to stop being Trump's Twitter fool, imagining the president-elect's glee as we fall for his deliberately provocative tweet, like Pavlov's dog. Quote, in the villainous golden lair he maintains in Trump Tower, baby Donald laughed his best Dr. Evil laugh. Got him again, he thought. Yesterday's settlement of the Trump University lawsuit is the real news, but my Twitter incitement will dominate all else for at least 12 hours. Close quote. Well, FAIR's Jim Noricus argues that the most important undercovered story of the Trump transition period might be the fact that Trump is the least popular president-elect in modern history. This information is important both for the strength of Trump's brand of far-right politics and for the potential for public mobilization to block his most damaging policies, if the public is aware of it, that is. The Hamilton audience booing Pence is far from a random sample, but it is, in fact, a manifestation of the majority opinion in the United States. Coverage of the controversy would have done well to make that clear. The scandals that the blogosphere scolds think we should be paying more attention to are important. They're mostly important because they illustrate the unprecedented corruption of the Trump regime. And that should lead to even greater unpopularity for Trump. In other words, stories like the Trump University settlement may lead to more stories like the Hamilton confrontation. And the laundry list of stories that bloggers offered as more worthy point to something that's clear about the Trump era. Journalists and others have to get used to paying attention to more than one scandal at a time. They're not going to politely wait their turn. But finally, it's worth looking at the racial element here, because one of the reasons offered by the mostly white blogosphere for paying less attention to the Hamilton controversy is that, in the words of the Daily Beast's Aaron Gloria Ryan, quote, a stage full of empowered and talented black and brown people openly questioning the ability of a conservative white man to effectively lead them, close quote, is one of those things that doesn't play well with the aggrieved red state populist. Now, the message delivered by Brandon Victor Dixon, he's Aaron Burr in the show, to the real-life vice president-elect was this, quote, we, sir, we are the diverse America who are alarmed and anxious that your new administration will not protect us, our planet, our children, our parents, or defend us and uphold our inalienable rights. We truly hope that this show has inspired you to uphold our American values and to work on behalf of all of us, close quote. Well, that's a critique that gets to the heart of what's wrong with Trumpism more clearly than any number of stories about hotel bribery. The suggestion that talented black and brown people should refrain from making such criticisms, or that when made, the rest of us should try to ignore them in order to avoid offending white racists, is a much bigger scandal than who's renting rooms in the Trump Hotel. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. For some people, one of the takeaways from the 2016 election was the importance of what's called intersectionality, the recognition that things like people's race, religion, gender, class, orientation, or immigration status are not isolatable factors, and also that what might be called economic anxiety, for example, can't necessarily be extracted from its racialized expression. Some even dared hope that wider acknowledgement of this might be a kind of silver lining of the election result. Commercial media don't seem to be advancing those sorts of conversations, but that doesn't mean they aren't happening. Social justice SOS, what happened, what's coming, and why we must join together against hate, was the name of a recent online event hosted by the African American Policy Forum, on whose board I serve, I will note. There were a number of speakers included across a range of fields. You can listen to the event on the website aapf.org. Today, we're going to just hear a couple of clips. First up is Sumi Cho, professor and associate dean at DePaul University School of Law. As media asked themselves why their predictions of the presidential election results were so wrong, one of the things we hear most about is polling. Cho talked about how it's not just the interpretation of polls or people lying to pollsters we need to think about, but polling methods themselves can misshape our understanding.
While 53% of white women supporting Donald Trump in light of his history, comments, and actions is truly astounding and disturbing, I want to suggest that it actually may be worse than has been portrayed, because Latinos and Asian American women likely supported Clinton and voted against Trump in far higher numbers than has been reported by the exit polls conducted by the National Election Pool. So how did this happen? Well, exit poll surveys aren't designed to actually reach representative samples of groups like Asian Americans and Latinos. And so we end up having one major national exit poll conducted for the National Election Pool, which all the major media outlets use. And the method that they use is conducted by Edison Research in particular. The method they use surveys Asian Americans and Latinos in a way that's statistically more likely to capture Republicans. How? Well, mainstream pollsters too often use too small a sample to be reliable. They don't construct samples that reflect the diversity within those communities, and they don't conduct interviews in Asian languages or Spanish at the first contact or ever. And so these practices taken together bias the sample because they tend to miss those in the polls that are more likely to be Democrats, that is immigrants, native language dominant, lower SES, younger voters. And so if you compare what's been said about the Latino vote, for example, by the National Election Poll, it said that they voted 29% for Trump, which is truly surprising since he wants to build a wall, right, to keep them out, you know, and 65% for Clinton. But if you look at the Latino decision polling, which was done by a number of coalitional groups that have expertise in reaching out to this community, it's more like 79% Clinton, 18% Trump. And when you look at Latinas, it's even higher, of course, with the gender gap, 86% Clinton, 12% Trump. APA population similarly, instead of 65% Clinton, 29% Trump, it was really 75-19. And when you look at women, 79-17. So finally, if you break out Jewish women from the category of white women, Jews voted 71-24 for Clinton over Trump, leaving white Protestant women voting 32% Clinton, 64% Trump. And so when you go into the narratives, you know, I think there's all these theses out that's being captured by like the New York Times trying to figure out what it did wrong in missing this election. And so you hear these dominant narratives of, oh, there's a sort of Ivanka voter, or there's this kind of good father, beautiful family thesis, or I want my daughter to be a successful businessman type of thesis. But buried at the back of that same New York Times article on the women who helped Donald Trump's victory, it finally gets to the issue of race, if you're still reading, and it states that these white women supporters of Trump are troubled by an America that seems to have embraced multiculturalism and political correctness without question. And they said they didn't understand the Black Lives Matter movement. They wondered why Democrats seemed so fixated on transgender access to bathrooms and tended to be enraged at the way veterans are treated and violence directed at the police, and that they were concerned about immigration and the threat of terrorism. And so it helps explain why all of the sexist, misogynistic, xenophobic comments and actions never disqualified Trump from being eligible to be president for these voters because of their commitment to a very racialized patriarchy.
That was DePaul University law professor Sumi Cho. Well, demographics help us highlight differing experiences, but intersectionality recognizes that people have multiple identities and can face multi-layered sorts of discrimination. All of the speakers emphasize the importance of seeing people whole and connecting across difference. That's something pundits often talk about, but organizers actually do. One such organizer is Alicia Garza, co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Here's some of what she had to say.
I think that one of the things that is scaring me is that I'm starting to see the left as a broad kind of swath move back into some pretty dangerous tendencies. So one dangerous tendency is to
to assume that because we are terrified, anxious, fearful, and scared, quite frankly, of what the potential of this kind of not just administration, but political terrain means for our communities right now and in the intermediate term and in the long term, there's a tendency that we then have to go back into our silos. So we are under attack. My particular group is under attack. I don't have time to think about what your group is dealing with. I just need to fight like hell to save my own people. And that is the worst possible thing that we could be doing right now. There's no better time than now for us to really figure out how to work intersectional politics in practice. And with that, we also need to make sure that we are not just talking to people who already agree with us, but that we are reaching out to folks who, quite frankly, I mean, the comments earlier about people saying, well, I'm confused about what is the Black Lives Matter movement? I'm upset about why people care about why trans people should be able to use bathrooms. We need to do a better job of reaching out to those folks and making sure that our vision also is a vision for them. And that is different from capitulating to the worst tendency of this moment. Under no circumstance should we normalize, capitulate, negotiate with, compromise with any vision that removes humanity from anybody. And we need to be really careful about that, because I do think that there's a failed strategy, right, that people call playing for the center, but what they actually mean is camouflaging themselves as part of the right, and they're very different things. I mean, when you look at those maps, it is very clear what we need to be doing. And to me, I think one thing we've got to be really, really clear and strong on is that there is nothing at all that replaces grassroots organizing. Absolutely nothing at all. And I think it's important for us to continue to think about how do we use technology-based tools to reach more people, but it is not a substitute for having real conversations with folks in real plain language, right? That really puts out not only what's at stake, which we're really good at, we are really good at sounding the alarm and being like, we're about to run over a cliff, but we're not that great yet. And we need to get much better about being able to talk about what's on the other side and really paint that picture in a way that people can taste, touch, feel, and smell. Another thing that I think is really important here is to do both. So as Mary Frances said, absolutely 100% active opposition to all of the reactionary policies and practices that are moving in real time right now. But that deep organizing piece, I think we also need to make sure that we are locating that appropriately in the Midwest and in the South and being led by folks who have been doing that organizing isolated from the rest of the country, and quite frankly, overshadowed by the visions and the strategies that are coming from people on the coast. We all have something to contribute, but I think if we're going to get real about what strategies will work to change what that map looks like, it absolutely needs to be led by folk who have been treading water in this landscape for a long time before the rest of us started to really feel it, touch it, taste it, etc.
That was Alicia Garza of Black Lives Matter. You can find the full Social Justice SOS webinar on the African American Policy Forum website, aapf.org. Thanksgiving is one of the times U.S. media feature a view of history that is, to be generous, hazy. Much of the talk of Native and settler bread breaking will reflect not the actual events, but the story that powerful people have chosen to tell. Last year, Counterspin spoke with James Lowen, author of the classic book Lies My Teacher Told Me, who explained how Americans are mistaught some of the most fundamental events in U.S. history. And this misunderstanding of history very much affects present-day politics, including race relations. Lowen started by talking about the then-pending removal of the Confederate flag from the State House in South Carolina.
Well, let me say, first of all, that I think it is very important that Governor Haley came out against the flag and that it looks like it's going to succeed, that the flag will come down from this place of honor right in front of the state capitol. Of course, a while back, it did come down from on top of the state capitol, which is just an astounding placement if you think about it, because it implies, you know, the flag flying right over the place where the laws are made certainly implies that the laws are made in obedience to what that flag means. So let's look for just a minute at what that flag means, because unfortunately, most of the people who are right now flip-flopping on the flag, and again, it's wonderful that they are reversing themselves. But most of them still don't have the, well, either the knowledge, perhaps, or certainly the guts to actually say that they've been getting it wrong all these years, and they need to say what the flag stands for. The Confederacy seceded, many people think, for states' rights. And I know they think this because for the last, at least 7 years, and certainly for the last 5 years while we've been in the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, I've been going around the country asking them, why did the South secede? Now, this is the most important thing that ever happened in the history of this country because, of course, the secession of the South and its firing on various forts, particularly Fort Sumter, led immediately to the Civil War, which is far and away the most important thing that ever happened after we organized as a country. So this is very important. Why did they do it? And you always get four answers. You get the South seceded for slavery. It seceded for states' rights. It seceded because of the election of Lincoln. And it seceded over tariffs and taxes, or issues about tariffs and taxes. And then I ask people to vote. And what's interesting is it doesn't make any difference whether I'm asking them in Columbia, South Carolina, where I have, or Greensboro, North Carolina, where I have, or in North Dakota, where I have, or an overwhelmingly black audience in Memphis, where I have, or in Southern California. The answer comes out almost always the same. And here's how it comes out. About 15%, sometimes 20%, say the South seceded over slavery. 60% say, sometimes 65, say the South seceded for states' rights. About 2% say the South seceded because of the election of Lincoln. And about 10 to 30%, this is the one that varies the most, say that it was all about issues about tariffs and taxes. So then we look at the facts, and it's very interesting. The facts are perfectly easy to find. The most important single statement is by South Carolina because it seceded first. But every single statement, every single state makes a similar statement when it leaves the United States. Here's what South Carolina called its statement. Quote, declaration of the immediate causes which induce and justify the secession of South Carolina from the Federal Union. That kind of sounds right on point, doesn't it?
Yes.
And here's what they say. They actually say, we assert that 14 of the states have deliberately refused for years past to fulfill their constitutional obligations, and we refer to their own statutes for the proof. Now, constitutional obligations sounds kind of vague, but they go right on to tell us exactly what they mean. The Constitution of the United States, in its fourth article, provides as follows, quote, no person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim to the of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. Well, that's, of course, the Fugitive Slave Clause. And they then go on to tell us which states are exercising their states' rights in various little ways and making various little interferences. They say the states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, blah, 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 they name 16 of them in all, ending up in the West with Wisconsin and Iowa, have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. In many of these states, the fugitive is discharged from the service or labor. So, in other words, it is all about states' rights, except the South is against states' rights. And what it's really all about is, of course, slavery. So we completely misunderstand the most important thing that ever happened in the country. Now, why do we misunderstand it? Well, I'm going to give you two reasons. First thing we need to do, any historian will tell you, we need to look at when we started to misunderstand it. And we didn't misunderstand it at the time. How could we? Mississippi, Texas, every single state says it's slavery. That's why we're leaving. So we didn't misunderstand it then. We started misunderstanding it mostly between 1890 and 1940. And this is the era that historians call the nadir of race relations. Nadir is, of course, an English language word meaning low point. So during this era, 1890 to 1940, the United States goes more racist in its thinking, in its ideology, than at any other point. This is when lynchings reach their all-time high. This is when so many towns across the North go sundown. That is, they throw out their black populations, or they, if they don't have any, they make a decision formally or informally that they're never going to have any. And they post, some of them post infamous signs at their city limits, like Manitowoc, Wisconsin, saying, quote, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Manitowoc," unquote. So at this point, when this, the neo-Confederates start saying, no, 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 it wasn't about slavery, it was all about states' rights, the white North really doesn't have the gumption to argue with them because they're participating in racism so heavily themselves. So that's one explanation. But the other explanation is to look at today's textbooks. And one I like to pick on is the largest textbook ever invented for middle school in this country. It's called The American Journey. It's by three it's a history of the United States. It's allegedly by three famous historians, Joyce Appleby, Alan Brinkley, and James McPherson. And so you would think that the stuff on the Civil War would be by McPherson, because he wrote what I think is the best single-volume history of the Civil War. But when you read it, it turns out it completely mystifies what secession was all about. Mm-hmm. Now, McPherson knows. So what we know from this is, it turns out, that these people who allegedly write the history textbooks don't write them. The publishers write them, and then they rent their names and stick them on them. But they don't even read them. Now, I mean, I tell, when I'm lecturing about this kind of thing to college students, I say, now look, if you are such an idiot that you actually buy your term paper for $9.95 from the web, I hope you at least have the brains to read the darn thing before you hand it in to your teacher. So I know that James McPherson never even read what he says about secession in this book, because he'd never put up with it.
He knows better.
Yes.
That was James Loewen, author of the classic Lies My Teacher Told Me. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. Take it, gentlemen.
Hi, I'm David Kenny, inviting you to join me for the annual Everything Old is New Again holiday concert to benefit WBAI. It's Sunday, December 4th at 12:30 p.m. at the Metropolitan Room. Again, that's Sunday, December 4th at 12:30 p.m. at the Metropolitan Room for the Everything Old is New Again holiday concert to benefit WBAI. For more information, visit give2wbai.org.
He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good, so be good, for goodness sake.
Oh, no. It's my sweetie's birthday tomorrow, and I forgot to buy a present. It's 3 a.m. Nothing's open. What am I going to do?
I have an idea. Tickets. I'll buy tickets to a fantastic event. I can do it anytime, even now, 3 a.m, by going to the WBAI donation website, give2wbai.org. There's a great selection of plays, events, discussions, concerts, movies. I'll definitely find something. All I have to do is click on the header that says tickets. I'm saved! Happy birthday, sweetie! That's give2, WBAI.org, and click on the header that says tickets.
The WBAI Community Advisory Board is holding open meetings for all to attend on the first and third Sundays at the atrium at 60 Wall Street in New York. So, what's the cab? Well, we advise management on programming, and we volunteer and help out at the station. So please come. Bring all your questions and your opinions. And again, that's on the first and third Sundays of the month at the Atrium at 60 Wall Street, New York.
New York, New York, it's a hell of a time.
And when they say it's a hell of a town, they mean it's a hell of a town. But it's WBAI in New York, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. The previous program, Counterspin, was brought to you on recording. And by the way, Lies, my teacher, told me I have to read that book. I really do it. I mean, I could do a whole show on that. Just, you know, if nothing else, just covering the American Revolution, geography, and all this. By the way, new factoid. Where the deer and the antelope play. I am going to ask this morning's contestant, Matthew Kressel, what kind of antelope we have in the United States or any of the Americas?
I have no idea.
Okay, that's a good answer.
Do we have antelope?
Wow. No.
We don't.
We never have.
Okay. That would be my guess.
We have an animal called the pronghorn. Okay. Which looks something like an antelope, but is actually related to the giraffe. It is not an antelope. It can't leap. Antelope can leap. Pronghorns were almost extinct, but they were brought back in the 1930s, thanks to some program FDR brought in or something like that. And they exist, and they are often called antelope. And when you look at them, you say, well, they're sort of antelope-y. They've got horns and everything. That's why they're called pronghorns, but they're a cross between okapi and giraffes. They are their own species. So where the deer and the antelope play, we were taught that in school. Dear little boy of mine, for those who know I think it's Tom Paxton wrote that song. I'm shocked they didn't play that in that episode of Counterspin. It's like, what an oversight. At any rate, you know that it's WBAI, because I'm just mouthing off at random, which means it's time for Hour of the Wolf. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, editor, writer, all kinds of stuff, highly respected, nominated Matthew Kressel. You've heard him here before. Stay tuned to hear him again.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Is there any particular reason that the only time Disney gets close to a reasonable female body image is when they're dealing with Polynesians, African Americans, Chinese, Native Americans? All those women, when they become Disney princesses, have gone through the Mouse House's Unreasonable Expectations diet camp. Yet, in the 2D animated film Lilo and Stitch, the human child of the title, Lilo, a Hawaiian resident, had a teenage sister who admirably had a little meat on the bone. And now with the new computer-animated film Moana, we finally get a Disney princess who doesn't look like the last piece needed to complete a Benetton's Barbie collector's set. Moana, voiced by newcomer Ali'i Carvalho, is, of course, also smart, resourceful, self-aware enough to have doubts about her ability to complete her mission, which is to rescue her small island community from a life-sapping evil by traveling across the sea to return a glowing stone heart to a benevolent island goddess, but ultimately courageous, as befits most latter-day Disney princesses. And thanks to the assured hands of directors Ron Clements and John Musker, who led the Disney revolution with The Little Mermaid and Aladdin, as well as helming the underrated Hercules and Treasure Planet, Moana is a thrilling, funny, and moving adventure. Everything Frozen should have been, but wasn't. Clements and Musker used their first foray into 3D computer animation to create rich, tactile landscapes, and lace their seas with luminous blues and greens. They gleefully mix media, among other things, giving the playful demigod Maui, voiced by Dwayne Johnson, a 2D animated tattoo to serve as Greek chorus, and allowing composer Lin-Manuel Miranda, along with co-composers Mark Mancina and Opedia Fawi, sufficient opportunity to capture the mood with their songs without making it feel as if the narrative has become a slave to the songifying. There are no particularly big surprises to the narrative. It follows the template well established in The Little Mermaid and locked down in Beauty and the Beast, but I found myself moved and entranced in a way I haven't been before, even with those classics. It's not been the best year for animated features. It's not been a great year in general, admittedly, but we do have Kubo and the Two Strings to hold on to, and now Moana, and that rescues things a bit. In other news, you should not confuse the new, very strange French film Evolution with Ivan Reitman's very bad science fiction comedy Evolution of 2001. The older film had David Duchovny giving a giant, cephalopod-like creature an enema. This newer film features a moment when a young boy is bound chin-deep in a water tank while a pair of amphibious humanoid infants nurse at his genetically modified navel. That's one of many disturbing images in a tale about a group of boys being tended to and experimented upon by a group of women on a remote island. Yet the most unsettling aspect of this film may be how director Lucille Hadjihalilovic has her group of children greet the various atrocities inflicted upon them with stoic acceptance, all except for the protagonist, Nicholas, played by Max Brodbrandt, who can't help but question his situation and who's prone to filling a hand-drawn diary with images of things that exist nowhere on the island, things like bicycles and Ferris wheels. There is a certain cephalopodic aspect to the women as well, which may be the only parallel this Evolution has to the Reitman one, but the outlook holds closer to a Herzogian notion that to evolve doesn't necessarily mean to attain humanity. And I'm fairly certain that this Evolution will not be getting a Saturday morning cartoon spinoff. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
And thank you, Dan. Always an interesting perspective. I don't always agree with it, but then what critic can you always possibly agree with? Dan does a great job, and thanks. So, once again, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. These are the few weeks in between fundraising drives. We finished one in the first week of November, and it's going to be almost 2, maybe 3 weeks before we start the next.
This may